So I think now most people have settled down. That last week somebody sent me a copy of an article which was in the Guardian newspaper, the English Guardian newspaper, about how mindfulness is now becoming ever more mainstream. There's a huge number of British politicians and a few senators from the United States and people from Israel and other countries are learning mindfulness. And the person who was starting all of this, what he called secular mindfulness, John Kabat-Zinn, was actually just pushing back against what many Buddhists say, that this is Buddhism, you know, straight out Buddhism. And the quote which somebody sent to me was that this fellow in the United States said, well, you know, you can't just say that mindfulness is Buddhism, otherwise you would say that the law of gravity is English, because an Englishman invented it or discovered it. But I mean, that's just a very false argument. It's just like saying that, well, a law of gravity isn't scientific. It's not part of science. Of course it's part of science, just like mindfulness is part of Buddhism. You can't really divorce it. It is a part of Buddhism which has been going on for 2,500 years. And it's also, it shows that, you know, there's much more to it than is presented in, you know, these popular mindfulness courses. And in fact, even the idea of calling it secular mindfulness is an oxymoron, because, you know, the mind has always been part of the spiritual world. In fact, that science, materialism, secular, doesn't even admit that there is such a thing as the mind. Always saying the mind is some side effect, epiphenomena of the brain. So really, if they really want to say it properly and think it's got nothing to do with Buddhism, they should never use the word mindfulness, they should use the word brainfulness. Because only so it's brainfulness training. So in other words, they can only notice it works because parts of the brain light up. They can't see the mind lighting up in CT scans or brain scans or whatever. All they see is brain lighting up. So that tradition is brainfulness, it's not mindfulness. Mind is something completely different. So, secular brainfulness, fine. But really, mind is part of the spiritual world. And in fact, when people actually, this is an old little story, that the Aristotle, if you ever read Aristotle, always considered there to be six senses. And I mention this because the Western world, especially science, say they got their philosophy from the Greeks. And it would be great if they did, but they didn't. They made it up themselves. Because Aristotle said there were six senses. There was seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, plus the mind being the sixth sense. And he also called the mind a common sense, because whatever you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, the mind can also know that. Somewhere, science lost its mind and it lost its common sense. Which explains a lot about, yes, we have incredible scientific advancements. And I say this as a theoretical physicist. Yeah, we've got lots of gizmos, lots of time-saving devices, but we don't have the time. So there's something very terribly wrong there. It's because we have not actually focused and valued this thing which we call the mind. Mindfulness is actually developing this mind. And many of the techniques and things which are used is part of the Buddhist training of the mind. So, certainly the mind exists, it had six senses from the very original time. What is the mind? Very simple little party trick, because you can actually do this for your friends if people say, well, you go to this Buddhist temple, it actually is the mind. I want you to be honest now. If you feel happy, peaceful, put up your right hand. If you feel miserable, upset, wait for it. So impatient. If you feel miserable, upset, put up your left hand. You have to put up one of those two and keep it up. Happy, no, positive right hand, the negative left hand. Keep it up, whatever it is. Now, with your finger, please point to that happiness, point to that peace. If you're miserable, please locate it for me. Where is it? Come on, where is it? Some point to the head, some point to the heart, some point all over the place. Look what people actually do. Now, this is actually saying something, demonstrating something. Happiness is. You're not imagining this. Peace is a phenomenon which exists. You know it does. Fear, anxiety, fed-upness, grumpiness, they exist. How come you can't locate it? The reason is that these are things which define the existence of the mind. This is mind phenomena. Just like trees and lawns and plants and bushes, they define a garden. Over here in Perth, you've got this beautiful King's Park. You know you're in King's Park. Why? Because you don't see traffic, you don't see pavements, you don't see traffic lights, you don't see big buildings. It's something which defines a park. Something defines like a city or a suburb. There's something which defines a mind, and that is the things which exist in it. So if you can locate happiness, sadness, love, anxiety, fear, if you can locate it, that is where the mind is. And it's not in your body. If you're in love, having a wonderful time, you're happy, where is that happiness? It's not in the body. So, this says the mind, the body is, the mind is different than this body. Next little demonstration. Again, some of you have seen this before, but I've never had anybody find a refutation for this very simple argument. One of my friends from Cambridge, when I became a monk, he, you know, went to get married and just get a family, and his five-year-old daughter was asked at school, what is the biggest thing in the world? My daddy, somebody said. No, an elephant, they'd just been to the zoo. No, a mountain is bigger. No, said the daughter of one of my friends, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. Not even the teacher understood what she meant. What do you mean your eye is the biggest thing in the world? And she explained that my eye can see her daddy, can see an elephant, can see a mountain, and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. Genius, because it's perceiving things in a new way. This is called innovation. Seeing things from a different angle, not what you've been taught before, but a view of perception which you can't refute. So I was very pleased when I heard that. That girl eventually, I did postgrad work, no, PhD work in Oxford University in biochemistry or something. So a brilliant girl. She was only five at the time. But I said 9 out of 10, not 10 out of 10, because your mind can see everything your eye can see and things your eye will never be able to see, imaginary objects. It can hear, it can smell, taste, it can feel real sensations and imaginary sensations like phantom limbs. And it also has its own area of knowledge. In fact, everything you can ever know, everything can fit into your mind. Therefore, the mind is the biggest thing. Not in the world, because the world, you can know the world fits into your mind. The biggest thing is this sixth sense, the mind. That's a very powerful argument, simple, but it doesn't mean it's not deep. This is a problem which I have teaching Dhamma meditation, Buddhism, whatever, many times I make it so simple that people think, oh, it cannot be profound. Other times, I used to go to talks and people would say this really mumbo-jumbo that the goal of life is the ground of all being, the unity with all things, the beginning and end. But what do you actually mean? Oh, you know, just beginning and end of everything. To me, that was mumbo-jumbo. But everyone said, wow, that was so deep. That talk was so profound. Why? Because I couldn't understand it. So please don't get caught in that sort of rubbish. Instead, this is a simile which gets you to understand what this actually mind actually is. Something totally separate from the body and the brain. And there's all these great examples, you know, of people who've had, like Professor John Lauber's, the boy with no brain. I love these little science experiments because people say, okay, justify this. Where is the evidence? And the evidence, you can quote Buddhist scriptures, but people don't believe in that stuff. I do, obviously, because, and any Buddhist here, because there's an enormous amount of wisdom in there. It makes a lot of sense. But this Professor John Lauber, 1981, in Sheffield University, a long time ago now, but he was doing some experiments on people who had misshapen skulls. You would notice their skulls were out of the ordinary. Other people wouldn't, but this guy was the expert on your head shape. And anyone who had a slightly misshapen skull was in his program. He gave him a CT scan. This guy, he was a postgraduate researcher in maths. He'd already got an honours degree in mathematics, the bachelor's, and now he had a steady girlfriend, totally sort of stable person, and when they did a CT scan of his brain, there was no brain there. Nothing, I think it was 1% cortex on the outside, but no amygdala, no this idlia and that idlia. I don't know the names of all these things. But he had no brain. And that caused a huge amount of problems with people who think, oh, this part of the brain has to light up when you're mindful, this is what lights up when you're anxious, this lights up when something else happens. Nothing was lighting up at all because there was no brain in there. Cerebral fluid, cerebral spinal fluid, whatever it was. And there was no way to explain that other parts of the brain were compensating for this lack of gray matter and other stuff. And remember just checking this out with somebody who was in Sydney, and they said, yeah, I've seen those CT scans. They were done not once, many times, just to make sure there was nothing wrong with the machine. And he said, you wouldn't believe just how much problems this is causing for neuroscience. Challenging billions of dollars of research, challenging reputations, which were made out of a lot of research. And what happened to it? Back drawer of a filing cabinet, too difficult, is called anomaly. In other words, too difficult. But there it is. The mind is something different than the brain. That guy had a mind, but no brain. And all this other stuff, near-death experiences, people whose brain was not functioning anymore. This is so common. I was giving a lecture in one of the hospital, Renchi Hospital, over in Singapore about the dying process. I was having a person who was a doctor, palliative care specialist, you know, what happens up to the point of death, and Mara was supposed to say what happens from that point of death afterwards, you know, the spiritual side. But it's something which I have noticed many, many times. Just, you may be in a coma, maybe dementia, maybe not able to communicate at all with anybody. In the last few minutes of your life, you wake up. Can speak, can see, can say, and then you die within a couple of minutes. Even shorter, sometimes longer. And because I was with palliative care doctors and nurses, Quick show of hands in my audience, maybe about 100 people there. How many of you professionals have had that experience? And about a third of them put their hand up. Nurses, doctors who've been by the bedside, that their patient had become awake in the last few minutes of their life, the last few moments. I'm not sure if she's here this evening. There was a girl here, one of the regulars. She was with her father dying at, you know, in one of the hospitals here in Perth. Her sister was with her, sitting on either side of the bed, holding their father's hands, been in a coma for hours or days, I forget how much. But then they were just sitting there waiting for that last moment when he would pass away. No, you don't know when that moment comes. And so they were waiting there, and then suddenly, without any warning, the father opened his eyes, leant up, looked around, the two daughters, and they, without any pre-planning, they both blurted out at the same moment, "We love you, Dad," and he fell back and died. It's very common. So how can that work when at that time the brain is not functioning? So it does actually say there is such a thing as a mind. And what we're doing in mindfulness training is actually, first of all, acknowledging the existence of that mind, not of the brain, but of the mind, and learning how to use it, you know, for our many, many benefits in life. Now, because, you know, I've been training that for, you know, all my life, basically, and also there's so much knowledge, so much information, which has been developed over 25 centuries of, you know, Buddhist meditation, that, you know, basically we do have the goods on this. Just mindfulness by itself, as you listen and read in those books, is not enough. Mindfulness is being taught to soldiers who go to Iraq and go to other conflict zones, so they can be more accurate in their killing. Is that really a good use of this? To be more mindful, so that when they're playing the stock market, you know, they can actually just see their greed coming up, and they can just follow it without fear. Mindfulness is a tool, which is like a chainsaw. You can use it to lock people's heads off, or you can actually use it to, you know, do something useful. It's not just a tool. There's always a moral imperative on how we use these tools. Like nuclear energy, you can make a bomb, or you can actually create sort of it's a bit debatable, but whether it's a fuel source which doesn't pollute the atmosphere, it's climate neutral, sort of, maybe. But anyway, it's not just the thing, it's just how we make use of it. And the classic story, because you have to find out little metaphors so people can understand this, was the person, a very rich person, who came to a Nolamara temple one evening, and because she lived in a big mansion in one of the wealthy suburbs of Perth, now, she had a little gatekeeper on the door of her house. And she told the security guard, "There's been many reports of burglaries in this neighborhood. So, I'm going to the temple tonight. I want you to be mindful." And he said, "Yes, I will be mindful, madam. I've done many mindfulness courses. I will be aware. I'll be mindful." And so she came to the temple, listened to a nice talk. When she went home, she found her house had been ransacked. Hardly anything was left. So she asked the security guard, "I thought you're supposed to be mindful." "But I was mindful, madam. I was very mindful." "Well, how come the place has been robbed?" "Oh, madam, I saw the burglars going in. I was very mindful. Burglar going in, the burglar going in, burglar. I noted they were going in. Very mindful. Very aware, and I saw them going out with all your jewelry, mindful of the jewelry going out. I saw them backing their truck in into the driveway, and I saw them take your safe out. I was very mindful all the way, madam, I was very mindful." Just like we have security guards outside, which, you know, we supply for you at no expense. It costs the Buddhist Society a lot of money to the security guards outside. Imagine that you find the security guards of Buddhist Society West Australia hires to look after your cars. Imagine you find all the cars have been robbed, windows bashed in, stuff taken away. And you ask the security guard, "Well, you might, oh yeah, yeah, I was mindful. I saw the burglar coming up and bashing the window and taking the stuff out." Would that be a good security guard? Of course not. It's not just about mindfulness. It's just, that's only half of it, even a third of it. In Buddhism we say it's 1/8 of it, of the Eightfold Path. There's more to it than that. The mindfulness carries consequences, and those are moral consequences. It opens up a choice for you. It does give you more options, but with those options, more choices in your life, you need a moral background for that. A spirituality of kindness and goodness and wisdom, how that kindness can manifest in the best possible outcomes. It's not just about awareness. And number two, that's why that instead of calling it mindfulness, you know I've called it kindfulness. Because just that change of that first letter from mindfulness to kindfulness does mean that it's more important that you're not just aware, but you are kind as well. Now that changes a lot of the practices of mindfulness. It's not just about, you're sitting here, your mind wanders off into thinking about this, and you have to keep bringing it back again, and you're mindful, and then you go bringing it back again and bringing it back. You know, I did that for years. It never worked. You bring it back, and it goes off again. Bring it back and goes off again, bring it back and goes off again. Why? And that's where, I soon understood. Teachers told me this, but you had to see it for yourself. Why does the mind keep wandering off? What's it running away from? It's running away from me. I had a very bad relationship with myself. I wasn't good enough. I could do better. And I was actually pretty successful as a young man. Even so, you can do better. Yeah, you get a good degree, but you can get a PhD. You can get a double PhD. You can get a prize, you can get a Nobel Prize. You can get, even a Nobel, you can get two Nobel Prizes. Why get one? There's no end to self-improvement. That, to me, was the problem. If any of you are coming here to improve yourselves, forget it. You just get more stress and trouble. And so, I was a rebel, born a rebel, always a rebel. So if you think I'm a fundamentalist, traditional Buddhist, stop it. Because actually, you are a traditional Buddhist. Traditional Buddhist, you're supposed to rebel, ask tough questions. And so the question was just, who said something's wrong with me? What is the idea? What am I supposed to live up to? What are you trying to be? What is your goal for existence? And the answer was, I tell this almost every week, go to King's Park, go to a forest, find a perfect tree. Your perfect tree will never be straight. It'll be crooked, bent, all damaged to the bark, scars, broken limbs, leaves which have been chewed up by the bugs. That is actually the most beautiful tree. The trees which aren't perfect. You go and find that out, and you'll find that that's the tree you love the most. Mine's bent and crooked, just like you. I'm bent and crooked, you're bent and crooked. I tell terrible jokes, you tell terrible jokes, which is the segue for the terrible joke today. And this comes from our librarian, Mahinda. So is he here? He's here. You better get out quickly because people are gonna blame you for this one. There was this Australian guy. He'd been married for many, many years. His relationship was a bit rough. But he lost all his money, nothing left. So he decided to just try and solve two problems in one. So he decided, first of all, he went to the insurance company and took out this massive insurance, life insurance policy on his wife. And then he went to one of the bad pubs in Northbridge and found a guy who would, you know, kill his wife for a fee. The going rate was $10,000. And he said, $10,000? Can't afford that. You know, but I will pay you once the insurance money comes through. And the guy, the assassin, his name was Artie, he said, well, it'll take $5 deposit. So he gave $5, that's all the money he had, $5. So he gave $5 to Artie, and Artie just followed his wife, found her in Woolies, in the fresh food section. And in the fresh food section of Woolworths, he crept up behind her, strangled her. But unfortunately, the supervisor saw him, so he had to strangle him too. But he was caught on CCTV camera, arrested, and convicted. And the headlines in the West Australian, our local newspaper, was, Artie chokes two for $5 at Woolworths. Blame our librarian, he'd set that one in. Artie chokes two for $5 at Woolworths. That, I'm bent and crooked, I can't resist telling bad jokes. You may still think that's a terrible joke, but I guarantee you'll tell that to the first person you meet afterwards. Anyway, most of you will, anyway. So stop trying to improve yourselves. Otherwise, you'd always be mindfully just trying to bring it back this way, bring it back this way. It becomes endless if there's no kindness there. What is kindness? Open the door of your heart to this moment, to yourself, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. That's why also, instead of calling it just kindfulness, sometimes I called it unconditional mindfulness. Mindfulness with no conditions on it. In other words, kindness, allowing everything to be in this moment. Then people keep asking me, well, just if you're just mindful like that, then nothing will get better. You know, you can't heal this depression or this psychosis or this thing or this whatever else it is you think you've been told is wrong with you. Somebody else has diagnosed that, hasn't they? Told you there's something wrong with you. And what happens is that if you are mindful and kind, allowing yourself to be, then much of those problems start to disappear and vanish. When I was kind to my mind, allowed it to be, then I was peaceful. I usually tell this story over at retreats. After 5 years as a monk, I was allowed to go out the monastery to travel around, stay by myself, visit some other teachers, broaden my experience. And I got to this wonderful monastery, perfect monastery. I was English monk, you know how I like my tea. This was in the middle of a tea plantation in north of Thailand. Everywhere I looked, there were tea bushes. I had as much tea, fresh tea, as I wanted. Beautiful cave, and the monastery was up in the mountains. It was the right temperature, not too hot. I was Westerner, so I like it cool, just the right temperature. And even better than that, no other monks were in this abandoned monastery because it was too peaceful for them. To me, that was brilliant. Nice. I can really do some nice meditation here. And I didn't need to give any talks. Lay people would come, just they wanted to feed me, that's all, nothing else. It was like idyllic, utopia. So I had all the time to meditate. You know what happened? My meditation got worse and worse and worse. More and more crazy. These thoughts were coming into my mind. First of all, just ordinary thoughts, restless planning, whatever. And then you started getting what I keep calling unmonkish thoughts. Now, I was only ordained when I was 23. So this is 28, 29. You know, still had it. Long gone now. But I thought, those old girls, I wonder if she's still available. No, stop it. And all this, well, you know, that I'm still young enough, I've still got a good degree, I can go and teach meditation as a living, you know, I'd do this and do that. Stop it, because I really wanted to be a monk. But every time I tried to watch my breath, bring my mind back onto the breath, my mind would go off again. Bring it back to the breath, it would go off again. And it got worse and worse and worse, until I thought I was going mad, crazy. I just could not stop these unmonkish thoughts coming up. So what I did, there's no one to speak to there, the monastery, I was by myself. They had a Buddha statue, I bowed to the Buddha statue and asked for help. And the inspiration which came up was, do a deal. You know, I was trained in the West, okay, deals, no, Mr. Trump. And the deal was this, I would watch my breath for most of the day, but I'd set aside 1 hour every afternoon from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. for any thought goes, sexy thoughts, weird thoughts, romance thoughts, that was my sexy time, as a monk, okay? I'm being honest with you, up front. But that 3 to 4 p.m. every afternoon, if mind wants to think about that, that's the time, the rest of the time you behave. I thought that was compromise. You know what happened? The mind was as crazy as ever. I just couldn't stop those thoughts. You know, you were aware I was mindful. My goodness, I was mindful. But they kept coming back in again. I could not stop them. And so it came to 3 o'clock, exhausted. I leant against the wall like, you know, many people do. Put my feet out. Okay, now any sexy thought you want, weird, fantasizing, deviant, whatever, okay. And this is no exaggeration. The next 1 hour, I watched every breath without missing one. So easy. And that really threw me. What is happening there? That was data, raw data as a scientist. How come when I was fighting my mind, all these thoughts would keep coming in? And as soon as I let go, my mind watched every breath without missing one. Easy, relaxed. And that taught me a lot. Mindfulness is not good enough. You need a bit of wisdom and kindness, first of all. It's from experiences like that I realized my mind was running away from me. Fantasies were just an escape. Romance was just, I never wanted to do anything else but be a monk. That was just something to do because I couldn't stand being with myself. I was not good enough, had a very, very bad relationship with this person called me. There was no kindness there. As soon as you started building kindness, open the door of your heart to yourself. I'm good enough. Doesn't matter. Sexy thoughts are not really appropriate for monks, but okay, come in. If you need to, fine. I'll let you come. I'll allow myself to be. That made me really peaceful and very still. That was a very important moment for me to realize that it's not mindfulness, it's not good enough. You need more than that. You just need the kindness. And to this day, if you are meditating, your mind wanders off here, wanders off there, it is escaping. From what? From you. So my mind and I have made up a long time ago. We've got this beautiful relationship together, my mind and me. Kindness. We are literally best of friends. If you're with a close friend, they just come into Perth tomorrow to visit. Is it really hard to take time off and make the time for someone you love and care for and are very kind, have wonderful memories of? So often when I go traveling, I meet some of my old friends. I remember meeting this, my old friend, his nickname was Flash in our monastery because, not in monastery, sorry, his nickname was Flash because at a party one night in college, he was so drunk, he went to the toilet and he came out without his trousers on. And all the girls saw him and he never lived out. He actually ended up becoming one of the most proper top accountants in the whole of Europe. When I reminded them, they said, "Be quiet, Ajahn Brahm, please don't tell. It'll ruin my reputation as one of the top accountants in the whole of Europe." But you know, he has stories about me as well, so that's why I won't tell you his name. But as soon as we met each other, hadn't seen each other for about 20, 30 years, just couldn't stop talking together. And he actually followed me all from London over to Wimbledon where I was going to give a talk, and we're chatting all the time. It didn't stop for about 2 or 3 hours. We were friends. When you're friends, you just, you know, you don't want to move away from each other. You're enjoying each other's company. You can talk for hours and hours. My mind and me are now best friends. So when I close my eyes, we hang out together. There's no controlling anymore. That kindness, that love, means that, hey, it's you again, Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, half an hour, just, you know, just chilling out before I give my talk. That is how we get the mindfulness and this other important quality, stillness. Your mindfulness and kindness, and then you relax and become still. And then something else happens, which I've never seen any so-called mindfulness cognitive therapy talking about at all, which is such an important part of mindfulness. Empowering mindfulness. Getting power mindfulness, superpower mindfulness, mega power mindfulness. And that is a really juicy part of mindfulness training. When you become really still, in other words, your mindfulness stays with something like the breath, doesn't go anywhere, doesn't want to go anywhere, just like a good friend. Then, because you don't have to do anything, the effort, the will, the struggle, that is part of this world which is the cause of the main problem. Doing too much, trying to improve, trying to get rid of this, trying to get rid of that, trying to do stuff, trying to be perfect, trying to live up to other people's expectations, trying to be the perfect monk, whatever that is. That's one of the reasons I've trained myself over many years to let my robe always fall off. On purpose. Yeah, you could. I could be really mindful and very strict and very straight and like that, but there is something missing in that. Something false. You're playing a game, you're playing a role, instead of being old Ajahn Brahm with the robe always half falling off. Because what you're doing there, you're being, you know, in this moment, being kind, being accepting. And because you're not doing too much, you're not struggling, it means that you are not wasting this thing I call mental energy. Why do we think? Because it's a problem we have to solve. When there's no problems, the world falls off. This is, you know, kids are welcome here. So it's okay to make a noise during the meditation. Please make more noise. Because that's challenging us to learn how to be peaceful with things which, you know, sometimes we think it shouldn't be this way. Of course, kids do that. That's what kids are like. So we allow the kindness to come up. We don't struggle, we don't complain, we don't keep thinking, we don't keep blaming, which means 99% of the energy you waste in your brain, thinking, planning, thinking how you're going to sort of solve this problem, I'm going to write a letter to the committee, no kids are allowed in here anymore, anybody who actually just, who passes wind, they have to sort of, you know, get sort of, you know, sit in the back or sit outside. We have a special place for farty people at the back somewhere. People actually think like that, complaining, thinking, you're wasting too much energy. Imagine you don't waste that energy at all. Not thinking, not complaining, not running away from this present moment, just being here, not trying to change yourself, not develop yourself, resting. Real Club Med, not the Club Med where you're doing something every day, but real Club Med where you can relax and just be kind, accepted, accepting yourself, not criticized, feeling safe. What happens? That energy which modern people waste, which is a cause of so many sicknesses and depressions and anger, that problem, lack of energy, lack of resilience, you relax so much, the energy starts to flow into being aware. You literally wake up. You become much more mindful, not through force, but through the natural strengthening of the power of mindfulness. Similar to turning up the lights in this room until they're so bright you see everything. Now that is part of mindfulness which I really enjoyed as a monk, where because your mind started to really get energized, all your senses became enhanced. You could see much more. Many stories about that. Gross stories. I refuse to tell the grossest story, but even in Thailand, doing walking meditation during the monsoon system on a concrete floor, I had to stop because walking meditation 2 meters in front of you, just watching where you were going, because there were snakes and other creepy crawlies there, even in the halls. So 2 meters in front, just mindfully walking, getting very peaceful and calm, not thinking about anything. And I had to stop because the concrete floor, which I saw, just like opened up. There were so many different shades of grey in there, and there were contours, like it was like a landscape. It wasn't just flat, and it became, now I looked at that, really, really beautiful. A very beautiful piece of concrete. And that's what it appeared like, just came out there, just all the different shades of the grey and the way it all met together and the sort of the contours of there. And I stood looking at that for about half an hour, and my thought was, cut it out, send it to some gallery somewhere. It really looked beautiful. And it reminded me of one of the poets I liked in the 17th century when I used to read poetry, William Blake. He was also a great artist. And that part of the poem, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. So-called mystical poet. But what did it mean? To see a world in a grain of sand? I saw a whole world in a piece of concrete. To be able to do that, you have to be mindful, and the mindfulness increases. So it's there, you see it. You've woken up. Your seeing sense has been empowered. It doesn't stop there. To see a heaven and a world flower, and actually smell that flower. You know, and sometimes when people really get into their meditation and they get very, very still, their mindfulness gets so strong, people, they say that they're smelling like fragrant sandalwood, you know, in the meditation hall. And they say, what the heck is that? So it's always there, but you haven't noticed it. You haven't been awake enough. Your mindfulness hasn't been strong enough. Let alone when you start to eat the food. People who go on meditation retreats, the food is always delicious, irrespective of the cook. You know the reason why? It's because your sense of taste is so great. Even small stuff is amazing. It's about 2 years ago, after I did I used to have a 15-day holiday every year, spent in my cave meditating, came out, breakfast, baked beans. Simple baked beans, you know, from a can, nothing special. My goodness, that's the first thing which I tasted after my meditation retreat, nice meditation. That was incredible. It was like literally a taste explosion in your mouth. Just a simple, three or four baked beans in your mouth after a deep meditation. Wow! I never tasted anything so rich before in my life. I think I'm going to have baked beans tomorrow, be nothing unless I have a good meditation tomorrow morning. But that's what it does. The whole senses become enhanced, empowered. and feeling in your body. You can really feel things now. Because a lot of the time people are asleep. Like now, we always think, oh, I'm awake. Are you? Sometimes when the meditation, mindfulness gets very strong, it's empowered. Wow, you really are awake now. That's why the word Buddha, it comes from a Pali word, bujati, which means to wake up. It literally does mean awakened one. Mindfulness has become strong and empowered. That becomes fascinating because it's also when your mindfulness really starts to get strong and empowered. You know the free gift, like in the cornflakes packet, like the frequent flyer points which you get when you fly. The free gift which you get with strong mindfulness is this. The happiness. Weird. But when you have strong mindfulness, your happiness, your joy increases enormously. When I was visiting England some years ago, visiting a prison, they just got a big Buddha statue in the prison, you know, permitted, a symbol of peace. And so I was there to consecrate it. We did usual three times around the Buddha statue, you know, and I was just really high. And there was two prisoners, which I saw out of the corner of my eye. They were just there because there was a big Thai feast afterwards. They were there for the food, nothing else. See ya. So what happened was I saw out of the corner of my eye, these two prisoners, they're looking at me, and they pointed to me, and they said, he's on the gear. Which means on drugs. That's the only thing they could understand was related to my happiness. Not at all. It was just mindfulness is very powerful. And this is where sometimes I think, oh, come on, John Kabat-Zinn and all the other mindfulness movement, come on, get your act together and put this extra stuff in. You're only just getting the tiny bits of it. You get this sort of the awareness, the wisdom, the kindness, and the joy starts really coming up. And that really starts to change you. What is depression anyway? Just people are just worn out. Their brain is so tired, fighting the life. Relax, let it be, and the joy really starts coming up. The happiness becomes intense. You know, sometimes I get sort of frustrated sometimes. Oh, you're not supposed to be happy, you're a monk. Where do you get that idea from? You're religious, you're supposed to not be happy. I'm not. I'm in here, 43 years now I've been a monk, for a good time. I'm a good time monk. I'm having a good time doing this job. And as far as energies coming out all over the place, teaching here, teaching there, tomorrow going to Singapore, a couple of retreats, and a AGM of a nuns group afterwards, and then going over to Colombo for another big sort of stuff, and just no rest at all, then going over to Cambridge for a debate with Russell Brand, that'd be cool. So, how can you do this? You should be jet. You've only just come back from England, are you going back again? Where's your jet lag? This is the trick which we learn as monks. Peaceful, still. Mindfulness gets very strong, really powerful, no fear. You get strong, no depressions, power. Mindfulness is only a small part of it. And I don't know why you can't open this up for everybody to have this incredible mindfulness, stillness, kindness, and really power up your minds. A couple of places I'm going to teach business people. Great, you know, you have to do good business. You have to make money. Otherwise I've got no donations to pay for my airfares and look after this joint. Sometimes I think I'm like a parent with so many children. I've got Buddhist Society West Australia, Ajahn Brahm Society in Colombo, Anukampa Bhikkhuni Project in London, Santi Monastery in Bundanoon, NBM Project, Newbury Buddhist Monastery in Victoria. What else have I got? I've got quite a few other things going on. So, only one monk, but I've got many dependents. I don't mind. Give and get into the mindfulness. You get power, energy, happiness. You got something to teach, something which the world needs. The kindness and the power of mindfulness. Take it further, for goodness sake. I haven't got into the health benefits of this yet. Wow. Resilience. I already mentioned about the guitar string. When you're stressed out, of course, little things happen. You know, you lose your keys of the car. Ah, why does this happen to me? You miss your flight. Ah. So you miss your flight, you get another one. It means one less talk you have to give. So that's not wisdom. That's softness, that's kindness, that's openness to life. So this is actually where the mindfulness really empowers you. So there's no such thing as secular mindfulness. That's an oxymoron. Two words go together, which mean the opposite. Secular brainfulness. Okay, brainfulness. Keep it materialistic. And don't understand the spiritual nature of the mind. It exists. It's powerful. Accept it. Develop it with the other things which belong in a garden. Kindness. Stillness. Happiness. Joy. No monoculture in a garden. You need many different flowers of different species. They work together. And I just mentioned a few of them. Virtue, obviously, is there too. Purity, compassion, kindness, wisdom, as well as mindfulness. We all know that monoculture destroys the planet. The monoculture of mindfulness without the other things. Sorry. It's just brainfulness. Just more of the same. So, let's see. If we can help. What's wrong with calling it Buddhist? What are we ashamed for? I know that people feel, oh, religion, religion, religion. We've had enough with religion. But look, Buddhism, you can come and go. You can ask questions. You can walk out the door. The only reason why in this place you leave your shoes outside, you don't bring them in. Has anyone ever told you why you have to take your shoes off? Because if I tell a very bad joke, it means you've got nothing to throw at me. That's the only reason. You know what happened to Mr. Bush? They threw a shoe at him. So anyway, so that's a little bit about Buddhist mindfulness as opposed to secular brainfulness. Here we go. See what we got for... Anyway, that's it. Sadhu. 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 Okay, any questions from the floor, first of all? Yeah, Eddie. Go quickly.
Mindfulness has always been a Buddhist thing. No?
Yeah.
5,000 years ago, the Buddha taught the four foundations of mindfulness.
Yeah.
Satipatthana
Sutta, yes.
So he taught us to be mindful of our body, our feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So, anyway, I totally agree with you, but, you know, it's, oh, you can call it whatever you like, but I feel it's just, you're missing so much of the boat. You know, sometimes, yeah, okay, it's a very powerful thing, but if you've got a car, and all you've got is a heater, and you haven't got an engine in the car, well, what's the point? So, you know, Buddhism is not just mindfulness, or to get something, spirituality, allowing a person to grow and solving the problems of this world, and even more than that. So, let's go for the whole hog and not just take one part of it. Just, a car needs more than one wheel. Usually 6 wheels in a car, 8 wheels in Buddhist practice. 6 wheels in a car, the four, and the spare wheel, and the driving wheel. Six-wheeler.
But there's a tendency, you know,
Oh, of course they can make it their own, as long as they take the whole deal. Okay, now we got someone from USA. Is there ever any interaction between the stream of consciousness and the brain? Of course there is. My stream of consciousness, my mind, is now interacting with my brain to answer this question. But you can actually sometimes get around the brain. Hypnosis is a wonderful way of getting around the brain, because people actually remember their past lives. You know, through hypnosis. You know, past life regression, we were talking about that earlier. And a lot of people do that, and they check it out afterwards, and it matches. That cannot be stored in the brain, because the brain has got no link to the previous life. They match it, and it's real. It happens. So the stream of consciousness and the brain, they interact, but the mind is bigger. It uses the brain, but it doesn't need to. From Sri Lanka, in Buddhist path, we are mindful to avoid bad mind states and to cultivate good mind states. This is one of the main objectives, but it's not good enough, because if you're just mindful, you don't use the other parts of the teachings, then you find you try to avoid them, but you make more bad mind states. Because you haven't got the full range of medications or whatever it is. You've just only got one. So just like food, you need a balanced diet. You just eat, like, well, what's a good food? Say just brown rice. Brown rice, good food. But if you just eat brown rice and brown rice and brown rice and brown rice and brown rice, that's not going to keep you healthy. You need the other stuff as well. So just mindfulness is just like just eating, it's good, but it's just like eating brown rice. What about the other stuff you need as well? From Lithuania, does the mindfulness change as a person comes closer or becomes a stream enterer? Of course it does. As you develop, your mindfulness becomes stronger. One of the reasons why we waste a lot of our energy and power by doing things is because we think there's things to do. I don't know, it's your weekend. What are you doing this weekend? How about doing nothing? People say, I'm traveling. No, I'm not traveling tomorrow. I'm sitting on the aircraft. The aircraft moves, I stay still. Different way of looking at it, isn't it? I don't move. Sit down there, and then just after a while, just you land somewhere, and you get off. I don't fly. The aircraft does the flying, I just sit there. Easy, isn't it? So mindfulness does change because it becomes stronger, more powerful, more happy. You understand more about what it's all about. Because you're a person, you think you have to improve. You're judging yourself. You see, who said there's something wrong with you? It's a big myth. You are as you are, and when you love yourself as you are, the door of my heart's open to me as I am. Stupid old Ajahn Brahm with all his bad jokes, stories I say every week, you can get online, that's who I am. So I made peace with myself a long time ago. Which means you don't need to improve. Isn't that wonderful? Imagine that. You don't need to improve. You don't need to go to school and get another degree and just please your husband, please your wife, please your boss, please, I don't know who else you want to please. It's endless, isn't it, pleasing other people? And pleasing yourself is even worse. You can get away from other people, you can't get away from yourself. So get a good relationship to yourself, then you become still. And then it really starts to become very strong. Lastly, from Germany, I cannot calm my mind when I get hit by heavy waves from an infection, not knowing how bad it gets. What to do the moment the wave hits you? It's like, what do I do when tomorrow morning I've got to do a year 12 exam and I haven't done the homework? It's a bit late, isn't it? Usually they say, come to the monks and get some blessings. Emergency treatment. And this is, I know that it is exam time because all these parents bring their kids to get chanting and all the everybody else. You get so many more young people come to the temple when it becomes, you know, close to exam time. They're desperate. Anything, please. But anyhow, here, it gets hit by heavy waves from an infection. You can't calm your mind. The whole idea of you doing it, that is the problem. Just open the door of your heart to the infections, whatever's happening. Come, let it be. Just like had all these infections of sexy thoughts coming in. Try to stop them, doing something about it, because I thought that's what I should do. And then it just made it worse. It'll be okay, 3 to 4 p.m. Just sit there. Okay, any thought, anything goes. And it's just so peaceful. And I let it be. That taught me so much about the nature of the mind and how we are the ones who mess it up. Just let it be. So easy. So, there we go. Any other questions from here before we finish off? Yes, Baker's last question is over 9 o'clock, yes. Because apparently that we don't have penalty rates anymore, so I can't, so I have to finish on time. Because I don't get paid penalty rates over there.
And me as well.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay. Double
Sorry,
penalty rates.
You've been talking a lot in the mindfulness about it making you happy. I find when I tap deep into my mindfulness, I cry instead.
Tears of joy and happiness. But it depends. If you allow it to be, nothing wrong with crying. So go for it. See how much crying you can do. It's only because, you know, the reason people cry is because they drink too much water. It gets to a certain level and it overflows. Okay, so you can see you don't take it that seriously. So they think, something's wrong. I shouldn't be crying. That's the problem. Oh, great.
I guess it's just unusual.
It's not unusual. It happens very a lot. This is, can't stop telling the story. Guy came on a retreat over in Jhana Grove, next to our monastery in Serpentine. He asked the same question in his interview. Getting peaceful, he started crying. And he's in his like mid-40s, Australian male. And he said, when was the last time you cried before this? When I was about 10 or 11, my father said, Australian men don't cry. And I said, sir, you've got a lot of crying to catch up on. And my goodness, he did. He was crying and crying, this meditation, every meditation. And at the end of about 5 or 6 days of crying, he still hadn't finished, but he got a lot of, no, he was a single guy, got a lot of propositions from the girls there, because if you want to be attractive, guys, cry during the meditation, you get so much sympathy afterwards. That's sexist, I know, but it actually works, you know. Be sensitive, cry a lot, and then, ooh. But why is it that men can't cry? What's wrong with it? There's nothing wrong with it. Go for it. So that's why it's a wonderful thing to do that. Nothing wrong at all. So don't judge yourself. Ooh. I should be tough, I should not cry, this shouldn't happen. Monks shouldn't be laughing, telling bad jokes, talking about the sex word. Ah, bad monk. Of course not. You know, you just are learning just how to allow this moment to be. And you find it actually grows and you become so peaceful, so happy. So go for it, have a good cry. On me, have three. There's one over here somewhere. Where's it going? Oh, yeah.
Speaking of sexy,
yeah.
Hugh Jackman was interviewed. He was voted the most sexy man by women.
You mean I lost that one? Where did I come? Number two, number three, number four?
Anyway,
I think I actually read an article that said that bald people have got more testosterone, apparently.
Well, with Hugh Jackman...
Yeah, go, sorry.
They were interviewing him,
yeah.
And... they said, what's the secret to your happy marriage, to your long and happy marriage?
Oh, yeah.
And he said, my wife and I, Deborah and I, we meditate together.
Oh,
every night we meditate, and that's the secret to our happy marriage.
There we go.
That, yeah.
You see, so if you do more meditation, then we wouldn't need any divorce lawyers. The lawyers would be out of business. Maybe. Exactly, yeah. So there we go. Meditate together, be at peace together. Excellent, marvellous. So meditation makes you sexy.
That's why we keep coming back.
Okay, my charisma. Look out, Hugh Jackman, I meditate more than you do, so watch your back. Okay, so let's now pay respects to Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, there we can do whatever we need to do. Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhan Bhagavantan Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.